from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. In this hour, after 6 years of planning, California Tomorrow launches an innovative program designed to curb carbon dioxide emissions. Supporters say the state's cap-and-trade system will reduce emissions that are causing climate change and spur technological innovation. But critics, including manufacturers and some economists, say it's going to drive business out of California by adding millions in costs to their bottom line. We'll hear both sides, and of course, we want to hear from you, too. We'll get started with Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, it's been 6 years in the making, and tomorrow, California is set to launch an innovative program to fight climate change. The cap-and-trade system was signed into law by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. It involves government regulators gradually reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that utilities, refineries, and some food producers in California will be allowed to spew out. And if they plan to emit more carbon dioxide than the allowable limit, the companies will have to buy pollution credits on a market run by the state. And tomorrow, California will hold its first auction of those credits, and there are plenty of critics. We'll be hearing from some of them this hour. Joining us to talk about the new cap-and-trade system, here in the studio with me, Craig Miller, science editor for KQED. He hosted and co-reported the documentary Heat and Harvest earlier this year. Good to have you here, Craig, as always. Also with me in the studio, Jasmine Ansar. She's an economist with the Climate Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Good to have you as well.
Good morning, Seth.
And joining us by phone, a familiar voice, Severin Bornstein, professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and co-director of the Energy Institute there. Good to have you as well, Professor Bornstein.
Good to be with you.
And also by phone, Shelley Sullivan, executive director of the AB 32 Implementation Group. That's a coalition that includes the California Chamber of Commerce and the Manufacturers and Technology Association, both critics of this system. Good to have you, too.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Craig Miller, before we get into the intricacies of this, just tell us, like, why does this matter? What is the significance of tomorrow when the system kicks in?
It's the California's cap-and-trade system is like the old Irwin Allen production in Hollywood, you know, 6 years of the making, which it literally has been ever since Governor Schwarzenegger signed the state's landmark global warming law in 2006. It is the centerpiece of a whole, I guess, suite of strategies to bring down carbon emissions. There are several others in the mix as well that either have already been implemented or not quite yet. But this will be the first time in America that there is a nearly comprehensive carbon trading program put in place. There's one that's been working for a few years in the Northeast, but it only applies to electrical utilities. This is going to cover eventually a lot more of the economy. They say it should capture 85% of the carbon emissions in the state. By capture, I mean it should cover that many. And eventually, over time, you know, all of these strategies taken together in AB 32, by the time we get to 2020, should amount to about a 15% reduction in carbon emissions from where we are now.
So explain for the layperson or our listeners, which are not necessarily exactly the same, but, you know, how's it going to work?
Yeah.
Or what's the theory anyway?
Yeah. Well, the theory is, you know, you have two parts to it, the cap and the trade. The cap is, you know, aimed at total emissions throughout the state as opposed to being aimed at individual facilities, which, by the way, is a point of contention with some, say, environmental justice groups don't like the fact that it's not targeting individual facilities. The refinery next door, you know, may not, in fact, decrease its emissions necessarily under this, but it's designed to attack the total amount of emissions that are the total carbon footprint, if you will, of industry in California. So the cap, we've likened it in our reporting this week to a game of musical chairs. You know, you start out, everybody's got a chair, you know. But eventually they start taking away chairs, you know. So initially all of the companies involved, they get allowances, most of them free, first time out. 90% of them will be given away free, that they can use to basically buy the right to emit carbon pollution. But like musical chairs, you know, it's actually not so much that the chairs get taken away. They start to shrink, you know, in about 2 years from now, the cap will start coming down, you know, 2%, 3% a year. And so this kind of forces everybody to kind of get into a smaller and smaller tent, he said, mixing his metaphors once again. And then there's the trade portion of it, too, that allows some flexibility underneath that big top, you know, so that the companies that need a little more wiggling room can buy it from companies that have extra.
So how does that reduce pollution if you're giving them the ability to pollute more than the regulators say they're allowed to?
Well, again, it's the cap. The idea that initially companies get allowances based on their current or recent production, but over the next few years, the total cap starts coming down. So starting, for example, about 2 years from now, you know, if you run a glass factory and you're covered by this thing and you've had to go out and buy or acquire allowances to emit so many tons of carbon, in about 2 years from now, you're going to have to start turning some of those back in. They call it surrendering the permits or allowances, and that's what makes the cap come down.
And how much do the allowances cost?
Well, there's a minimum bid price in tomorrow's auction of $10 a ton. These things are measured in metric tons of carbon.
So what would
we won't know exactly what the price of carbon is in California until after tomorrow's auction. We actually won't know until Monday when they release the results. But we're pretty sure it's not going to be less than $10 because that's the minimum set by the state.
So $10 doesn't sound like very much. How much might a factory have to pay?
Well, the minimum, I mean, the threshold for being covered by this program is, I think, 25,000 tons of metric tons of carbon a year. If you put that much out of your smokestacks, you have to buy allowances for that much or acquire them somehow.
And who does the money go to?
Well, that's an interesting question. The money will go – we haven't entirely sorted that out yet. You know, it'll become state revenues. It's not going to go into the general fund, however. It has to be used toward goals that, quote, you know, further the goals of AB 32, this umbrella law that covers cap and trade. So programs basically that help reduce carbon. It could be renewable energy development, you know, any number of things.
And Severin Bornstein, what have we learned from that other market in the Northeast that covers just electric power plants that Craig referred to? What have we learned from that or from similar systems like in the European Union, for example? What have we learned that we've put into the planning for this launch tomorrow?
Well, I think there are a number of things. A lot of them are in sort of the technical details. The bigger example is the European Union Emissions Trading System, known as the EU ETS, which has been running since 2006 and has had its problems in part because the allowances could only be used in specific years. So one of the things that's been done in this market is the allowances can now be saved and used in later years, so you aren't going to get as much price volatility because, of course, if all the allowances are about to expire, that creates a rush to use them, and they found that in the EU that the price crashed right before they expired. So one of the things they figured out is to allow these things to be what is called banked until later periods.
So
I think a lot of it, they've also been learning from mostly the EU ETS again about concerns about market manipulation and what people might try to do and how to avoid it.
And so is the goal really to put a price on pollution essentially and to try to give economic incentive or a penalty, if you will, to companies that will encourage them to what? To reduce pollution, to be more innovative?
Yeah, it's exactly that, to try to put a price on pollution and give an incentive to reduce pollution. Well, at the same time in California, recognizing the problem that California is not a separate economy. It's integrated in the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And so we're doing this with one hand tied behind our back, in a sense, because we have to deal with the fact that California, by the U.S. Constitution, can't really control its own borders. And so we have to still allow fair trade with other states. And there have been a lot of exemptions and special treatments to make sure that this doesn't cause significant economic harm to the state.
Like what?
Well, as Craig pointed out, most of the permits early on are going to be given away for free to companies in the state. And in fact, they're going to be given away in a specific way. They're going to be given based on how much output the company produces in California, not output of emissions, but output of whatever the good is that they produce. So it, by doing that, they're trying not to discourage production in the state by saying, if you continue to produce a lot in the state, you will actually be given a lot of permits. But you'll still have an incentive to produce whatever quantity you are producing in the most efficient way. Because if you produce 100,000 units of output, and based on that you get a certain number of permits, if you figure out how to produce that 100,000 units of output more efficiently so you don't emit as much carbon, well, then you're going to have extra permits left over, which you can sell in the marketplace.
Let me bring in Jasmine Ansar from the Union of Concerned Scientists. What is your group's hope for this law? Best case scenario.
I think the best case scenario is really that this is a model, and it's an example way, really, of how this system can and will work, and therefore that will spur other regions, other states, other countries to follow the lead of California.
And how long will it take to know if it's working, and how do you measure if it's working?
I think that's a good question. I mean, basically what we're saying is that, you know, California will demonstrate the ability of this system. And I think the way you'll know it will work is if, you know, economic vitality remains in the state and if emissions truly are reduced. And if, as we've already seen, for example, there's been a huge influx since 2006 of clean tech venture capital. And that's been, I think, a direct result of things like this landmark climate change legislation. It's provided the spur, the incentive for clean technology, venture capital, and other innovative industries to come into the state and to invest because they see that the market is here and this is leading, you know, certainly the nation, if not elsewhere.
Craig, is that how you see it as well?
Yeah, there's one big measure of success or failure of this will be the so-called leakage argument, this idea that, you know, that it's a billion-dollar tax, you know, as the oil industry has said, on businesses in California, and that businesses will start fleeing the state, you know, in the face of it. There are, you know, you can find reports that say that'll happen, and you can find reports that say that it'll be more than offset by the kind of influx of green technology and venture capital that Jasmine was just talking about. I've no doubt that some jobs may leave the state as a result of it, but it's really hard to say exactly how much leakage there will be.
So is it fair to say, Jasmine, that, you know, from an environmental perspective, if some of those jobs of quote-unquote dirty industries leave, it's okay as long as they're replaced by jobs in cleaner industries? Or is the goal really to, you know, that hopefully we won't lose those jobs?
No, I think the goal is to transition the economy to more of a producing less pollution and being, you know, free of carbon. So the goal is to transition away, to move away from the old horse and buggy type technology to the new technology. I think one thing that overwhelmingly studies have shown is that actually a lot of the new industries, such as the renewable industry, the solar industry, the energy efficiency industries, they're much more labor intensive. So actually, most of the results have shown that in net, there will be a positive impact on jobs and not a negative because, in fact, a lot of the fossil fuel industries are becoming much less labor intensive.
Well, let me bring in a dissenting voice, I suspect. Shelley Sullivan from the AB32 Implementation Group. I know that you, your group has been petitioning the governor to please stop this before it begins. What are your concerns?
Well, you know, I have to say that the business community has long supported a well-designed cap-and-trade program to help meet the goals of AB 32. But, you know, you have to keep in mind that AB 32 instructs CARB to implement
CARB, the California Air Resources Board.
Yes, I'm sorry, in the most cost-effective and technologically feasible manner. We don't believe that the current cap-and-trade program and specifically this auction is able to do that.
Why?
Well, we believe that there are many flaws within it, especially within the allowance allocations. We think that there should be 100% of free allocations in this first compliance period at least in order to help strengthen the cap and trade program. You know, there's a real distinction of a good cap and trade program that reduces the greenhouse gas emissions at minimal cost rather than an auction that's designed to extract billions of dollars from the industrial sector of the economy.
So the concern is what? That that even this relatively small cost at the beginning is going to have what impact?
Well, it's not a relatively small cost. It's going to extract billions of dollars from the economy. You know, even CARB acknowledges that it could result in up to a $25 billion in gross state product. And as they talked about earlier, Andrew Chang and company, their research found that California will lose $153 billion even under optimistic conditions.
So that other than that one tweak, which you say allowing 100% free, having 100% of the allowances free, what else would you see would need to change in order to make it work?
We would like to, again, see the free allocation of allowances to industry. We'd like to see a broad use of offsets, and, of course, there's the need to finish the offset program development. And also something that's very important that CARB is going to be, the California Air Resources Board is going to be working on next year is new economic analyses that will change maybe the certain leakage categories for some industries in the state of California, and that will determine their allowances that they need to comply with.
That is Shelley Sullivan, Executive Director of the AB 32 Implementation Group, a coalition that includes the California Chamber of Commerce and the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. We're talking this hour about California's new cap-and-trade program, which is going to kick into high gear tomorrow. Also with us, Craig Miller, science editor for KQED, Severin Borenstein from the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. He's also on the Emissions Market Assessment Committee, which advises the California Air Resources Board, and Jasmine Ansar from the Union of Concerned Scientists. If you want to send your thoughts, you can send us an email. It's forum@kqed.org. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page. We'll be opening up the phones at the bottom of the hour as well. Craig Miller, this is something no doubt that other states are looking at, but was there not a hope or even an assumption when the governor signed this in 2006 that maybe by now other states would be part of this?
Yes. There's even a name for it. It's called the Western Climate Initiative, or WCI, and initially there were supposed to be like half a dozen states and several Canadian provinces.
Where are they?
Signed on to this. Well, they've faded into the shadows for the most part with a kind of a wait deciding to adopt a wait-and-see attitude on what happens. The lone exception at the moment appears to be Quebec, of all places, which is not even Western.
Well, and there were other Canadian provinces involved at one point, weren't there?
Yeah, the British Columbia. I think there were four Canadian provinces altogether that were – and they're not – it's not like they're all – they've all said we're out. But I think many of them are saying we're going to wait and see how this goes.
They're not in.
They're not in.
So how much of that is the economy, would you say? I mean, in 2006, we hadn't hit the recession yet.
I think a lot of it is the economy. I think there was a lot of political pressure, and each of these states would have to adopt enabling legislation to do this. And I think it was a lot of political pressure during the recession on the legislators of each state and the governors of each state to not take this on right now.
And Shelley Sullivan, that because there aren't other states involved, do you think that ups the ante and the risk for California?
Absolutely. And we have always said that, you know, California going it alone is going to hurt our economy even greater. And it's interesting that actually there was an op-ed written by some of Professor Borenstein's colleagues that ran in the Sacramento Bee that talked about the fact that cap and trade should look to broader goals. And so it was talking about the fact that, you know, we need to look to a program that doesn't harm the economy and that will, and it's not going to yield substantive environmental benefits, you know, so we need to be able to implement a program that focuses on realizing the broader benefits down the road rather than attempt to achieve sizable emission reductions from state businesses in the near term.
Severin Borenstein, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, the op-ed has been widely misinterpreted by the industry folks. It did say that it was much more looking at framing the debate going forward because there is a lot of the details still to be worked out. But it endorsed cap and trade and said that we needed to do it in a way that minimizes the economic cost. And I think that A lot of that is being done. The industry actually is getting almost all of their allowances for free. They obviously always want more, but the idea that this is going to have a massive economic impact on the state is really not supported by any serious studies. There are a couple that have been paid for by industry that really are essentially add up all the costs and none of the benefits and then say, look, this is a big number. But the serious studies, I think, come out saying this isn't going to have a big negative effect. It likely will have a very slight negative effect on the economy, but certainly nothing catastrophic. It's also unlikely to have a big positive effect. The idea that this is going to launch California into being the green economy that will just take off is also not supported by serious studies.
Craig Miller.
It's probably going to be fairly neutral to the California economy.
I think it's important to point out that these free allowances, these 90% free allowances, are a temporary transitional measure designed to kind of grease the wheels of this new market, and that over time it does flip. I've seen projections that by 2015, more than half the allowances will be sold to companies. They'll have to buy them as opposed to getting them for free. And some businesses themselves have said that by 2020, they'll be paying for 75% of the allowances. And that's where these billions of dollars that Shelley's talking about would be coming from.
And can businesses that through innovation and other means reduce their pollution, can they sell some of these themselves?
Absolutely. That's the
so
whole
it's
point
the whole market.
It. Yeah. They can do that, or they can support programs that are designed to reduce carbon emissions in other ways. They can, in other words, write a check to reduce somebody else's carbon emissions by planting trees in a forest or something like that. That's called offsets. They can also use that as a mechanism if they get into a corner.
And how is this different, Severin Borenstein, from a carbon tax?
Well, let me just clarify that it is true that there is going to be less of the allowances given away, but that's primarily because gasoline is going to go under the cap in 2015. And the gasoline, the part that is attributed to your tailpipe emissions, will actually be priced at the pump. That is, the nobody's going to be given free allowances for that.
How is that going to work for drivers?
Well, the sellers of the gasoline are going to have to procure the allowances, and that'll just be like the price of oil or the price of distribution or anything else. And so if we have a $20 a ton price of carbon of the allowances, that's going to translate to about 18 cents a gallon at the pump.
But unlike a tax, it's not going to go to the general fund or to some other fund for transportation purposes.
It's going to go to the environmental expenditures of the state. I think that that's actually less of an issue since the state has a lot of flexibility in other areas to offset that. So it essentially is going to the state. But that's the primary revenue source. Most of the rest of the allowances for this program, which only runs through 2020, most of the rest of the allowances are being given away for free.
And there is, assuming this, if it doesn't work, if there are problems, there will be an opportunity to tweak it along the way, I assume?
There will be an opportunity to tweak it. There have been tweaks, obviously, up till now. I think they will try to minimize the tweaking since there is a market out there for these allowances. So they don't want to make major changes at this point. But I do think that the best outcome and the most likely outcome is this is going to be a non-event. There's going to be pretty low cost of these allowances, which the markets are already predicting, and everyone will go on about their business.
All right. We're going to continue talking about this in this hour with all of our guests, and we invite you to join us. It's 866-733-6786, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org or leave your comments or questions on our Facebook page. And by the way, you can read and hear more about California's new age of carbon trading, including an eye-catching breakdown of where the state's carbon emissions come from. You'll find that at kqed.org/cap-and-trade. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. And this hour, we're talking about California's new cap and trade program that was part of the AB 32 signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, the carbon market open for business starting tomorrow. We're talking about that this hour here in the studio with me, Craig Miller, science editor for KQED, also Jasmine Ansar, an economist with the climate program for the Union of Concerned Scientists. And joining us by phone, Severin Bornstein, a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and co-director of the Energy Institute there. And also by phone, Shelley Sullivan, executive director of the AB 32 Implementation Group. That's a coalition of businesses, includes the Chamber of Commerce and the Manufacturers and Technology Association. If you want to join us this hour for your thoughts, comments, questions, 866-733-6786. And during the break, Craig, we were talking about that last point Severin was making about the gas prices being sort of rolled into all this by 2015. For folks who – what about low-income people? Is there any sort of allowance for people? This is going to disproportionately affect people. You know, it's sort of like a cigarette – not a cigarette tax, but maybe a sales tax.
There is already a provision for some of the proceeds to be deliberately put back into low-income communities that might stand to be more adversely affected by this. That's different, I think, than consumer relief. There are some schemes for that as well. For instance, part of the plan is to take some of these revenues and assuming that electricity rates rise, you know, because there are two things people focus on, gas prices eventually in 2015 and also electricity rates. So electric rates go up, your electric bill goes up, you know, what are you going to do about that? Well, there's also a plan to take some of these revenues and basically give them back to consumers to offset that. But that goes to a different regulatory agency, the California Public Utilities Commission, which is kind of still working on a plan for that. We're not really sure how that's going to work.
Well, and that kind of raises the specter of the late 1990s, you know, when there was an attempt to regulate the electricity market in California, and it led to brownouts and all of that. How big a concern is there that, you know, by sort of tampering with this market, we're going to have unintended consequences?
Well, I'll defer to Sev in a minute on this, to give you a probably more complete answer on this. But the Air Board emphasizes that they have bent over backwards to study the problems that came up, and that there was tampering. There were actually
gaming the market.
Yeah, there was actually forged allowances in the early days of the European market, counterfeit allowances, things like that, you know, that they put a lot of security measures. That's one of the reasons why when the auction happens tomorrow, we can't be there. In fact, the companies who are participating in it aren't even allowed to discuss it really until afterwards.
Hmm. Severin Bornstein, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think there really aren't parallels to the California electricity crisis other than, of course, you need to be careful when you design markets. But remember, the problem with electricity is that it's not storable, that you really need to have that power the moment you turn the light on, and if not, you have a brownout. Whereas here, we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions over many years, and there's nothing comparable to the need to do it this second that caused the real problems in the California electricity crisis.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, and let's start down in Florida, in Panama City. Paul, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm a small business truck driver that frequently does business in California, and I can say that the trucking industry has made tremendous strides at reducing pollution and increasing fuel economy, so much so that, if I'm not incorrect, I believe it's UC Berkeley that just released a study that pointed out that you can drive a brand-new Class 8 tractor trailer 142 miles and still release less particulate matter than a guy grilling a hamburger, which brings me to a point, and a question. I believe that we can all agree that the number one factor in pollution is people, of which you have plenty of them, we'll be honest. So the question would be, do your panelists believe that it's possible to reduce pollution to significant levels solely through business regulation, or is it going to be necessary to incentivize individual behavior? I'll listen off air. Thank
you. All right, great. Thanks very much for the question. Severin DeFrizzo, do you want to comment on the hamburger study?
Well, we have to keep our eye on the fact that this is a program about greenhouse gas emissions, not about particulates, not about ozone or smog, and so it's sort of not relevant to our discussion. It is the case that this program is going to incentivize individuals. By raising the price of gasoline, it'll incentivize individuals. And through a lot of other places where there will be small changes in prices, that is likely the best way to get people to change behavior.
Craig Miller?
Yeah, if you look at California's total carbon footprint, spoiler alert, if you're going to go and look at our cartoon we have on the, you know, the biggest single chunk, nearly 40% of it, is the so-called transportation sector. And a lot of that is cars and trucks. And a lot of the ways that people are being incentivized right now to bring that down is by buying higher fuel efficiency vehicles, which, I mean, the number one, I believe I heard just recently, that the top-selling vehicle right now in California is the Prius.
Yeah. So how much of this is, just coming back to the caller's question, is designed to ultimately influence the individual beyond just driving decisions?
I would say that beyond that, it's not aimed at the individual. It's aimed at industry mostly. Yeah.
Well, except for the fact that individual families and consumers are going to be hit with the high cost of the pass-through costs.
In the form of what, food costs and that kind of thing?
Food costs, yeah. Gasoline costs, as you talked about earlier.
But isn't there already a pass-through cost for, you know, things like asthma and whatever else, you know, storms, hurricanes, floods, fires?
Well, I think that, you know, if we want to, you know, stay on topic, is that we believe that, you know, a simple cap-and-trade program without the auction is going to provide adequate incentives for companies to reduce their emissions through the efficiency and innovation program. So I think that we're already on track for that and that we don't need the auction to do that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Michael at Stanford, hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious if the panel would comment on how well they think the program is going to deal with electricity imports, and especially electricity imports from coal. We currently import about a quarter of our electricity from out of state, and I think that's a particular challenge for a one-state cap-and-trade program. So I'm curious if Professor Bornstein or anyone else wants to comment on how the program's handling that.
Jasmine Ansar, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, this is an issue that has arisen, and it's basically the issue of what's called resource shuffling. That's the technical term, and that's the issue that an out-of-state producer, let's say a coal producer, may now send the non-coal production to California and just produce the same amount of electricity from coal, but just send that to some other state. And I know that carbon, in fact, Professor Bornstein is one of the researchers looking at this issue and trying to identify the set of rules and criteria to identify this behavior and to develop rules and regulations to basically address it.
Severin, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, this is a major problem. Let's not kid ourselves. The California doing this on our own, without the rest of the Western grid, and particularly, I mean, without the whole U.S., this is probably the place where it creates the most problems. We don't have control of the entire grid, and so there's no way we can stop that coal plant in Utah that was shipping power to the California from just turning around and shipping it to Arizona instead. And that's just a fact of life.
California is not a big enough market that by itself it's going to influence those kinds of decisions about how the energy is produced?
Probably not for most of the existing coal plants. It has enough of influence that it will keep new coal plants from being built. But for existing coal plants, it's unlikely that it's going to have much impact. And that's one of the problems, that if the U.S. did this, they would not only be encompassing all of those grids, but they wouldn't be constrained, as California is, by what's called the Interstate Commerce Clause, which essentially says California can't control trade across its border. No state can in any way inhibit trade across its border. So when we get into this situation, particularly with electricity, because it just flows wherever it wants on the wires, it's very difficult to address that.
Michael, does that respond to your question?
That was great. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Good question. Shelley Sullivan, part of your group's concern, of course, is that this is only being implemented in California. Would your group support a nationwide cap and trade system?
Well, you know, as always, the devil's in the details, and so we would need to look at what that program looked like. But, you know, we have always supported a well-designed cap-and-trade program that, you know, reaches the greenhouse gas reduction goals within set forth within AB 32, as long as we're protecting California's jobs and the economy. And obviously, in the past 6 years, California's economy has changed quite a lot. But, you know, the devil would be in the details, but that's something that we have always, you know, agreed with.
Severin Bornstein, can you do that? Can you design a cap-and-trade system that protects, you know, all jobs?
At a state level, it's certainly more challenging. The state has gone a long ways towards doing it by allocating most of these permits for free and doing it in a way that ties it to continuing to produce in California. So that's really the best that the state can do, and it probably undermines some of the – it does undermine some of the incentive for reducing carbon, but it tilts towards making sure that it minimizes economic harm.
Here's an email from Adam who writes, is the 15% reduction based on current emissions or forecasted emissions? Craig?
Is the 15% reduction based on – okay. So I'm trying to remember which figure this was now. So if you look at where we are right now, it'll amount to about a 15% reduction from now. If you go out and look at where we would be in 2020 – assuming there was no cap and trade program and we were on a business as usual, as they call it, trajectory with emissions, which are still going up, by the way, you know, despite the recent recession, I believe it's about a 30% reduction.
Yeah. Okay. Severin, anything you want to add?
No. The one thing we do have to recognize when we talk about those forecasts is they're forecasts and they're just wild guesses. If I ask you what California's economy can be doing over the next 8 years, even if you are the best macroeconomic forecaster in the state, you're going to be pretty uncertain. And so we really don't know what business as usual is, but we do know what the program is targeted to reduce it to.
Craig?
We should probably also point out that those 15-30% numbers are also apply to the whole suite of strategies under AB 32, that the cap and trade portion of it, even though it's the kind of groundbreaking centerpiece of the whole plan, accounts, I think, for only about 18-20% of the actual emission reductions.
And what impact will the higher CAFE standards that are kicking in for auto emissions, does that get factored into that reduction as well?
I'm not sure about factoring in. It'll make a big difference in the sense that it is national. It's one of those things, and that it's a great example of one of those things that where California led and the nation followed. And I think there are a lot of people with their fingers crossed. Maybe Jasmine is one of them. Yeah. That the same thing will happen in this case. But I think there's a lot more uncertainty about cap and trade.
Actually, California has a long history of this. I mean, it's not only with CAFE standards. It's also with energy efficiency, with appliance efficiency standards, with building, you know, standards. So, you know, traditionally almost California has been the innovator. It's been out there and it's had tremendous success. I mean, we have our energy efficiency as a ratio of GDP is much lower than anywhere else, any other state in the nation. You know, we've remained flat basically since about the mid-70s, whereas the rest of the nation, energy has gone up as a ratio considerably.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Tom in Los Gatos, welcome.
Hey, great show, Scott. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's adding insult to injury not to charge royalties to oil companies with the massive profits, and so many people say gouging at the pumps, especially in a disaster area, which California could develop into overnight and, you know, a major earthquake and that sort of thing. Wouldn't it be better, instead of having the caps and trade and especially with gasoline, to just charge higher charge royalties to start with, and we could say we're truly a green state if we at least charge royalties like Alaska and all the other oil-producing states, except for like two or three, maybe Texas and one other. So it also charge royalties to, you know, auto companies if they want to sell their autos, especially the polluting autos with the big engines or you know, diesels is a good, you know, I was introduced earlier. And it's not, the hamburgers and diesels are two different things, the earlier caller was saying, because you don't produce, you know, fly ash when you're grilling hamburgers. That's only produced in high compression diesel engines with very high temperatures. It makes little shards of glass that come out with the diesel exhaust that gets embedded in people's and animals' lungs. So it's a completely different combustion process going on there and danger to our lungs.
Yeah. Jasmine Ansar, California is, I think, one of the only, if not the only state that doesn't tax oil production. I know that's been on the ballot. It's lost. But are there other ways of achieving some of these same things that may be considered, especially perhaps by the supermajority of Democrats now in the state legislature?
Well, yes. In fact, I was reading just this morning about an oil severance tax, which would, in effect, would amount to the same thing. But I did want to raise one point about the free allocation of allowances, which is if you look at the value of allowances that that are being given away to industry, it is actually the oil and the gas industry that are gaining the most, mainly because they're the largest industrial emitters. They produce the most pollution of all the industrial sectors. In fact, you know, if you do a sort of a rough calculation, they're going to get over $2 billion worth of allowances. That this is the public's money that basically they are being given in the hopes that they stay here. You know, I think just to compare, if you look at the electricity sector, for example, I mean, the electric sector, they will have to buy their allowances. They have already done a great deal to reduce emissions. They are now one of the lowest carbon intensities in the whole nation. You compare that to the oil industry and the refineries. In fact, the refineries in California, they produce the most carbon emissions per barrel than any other refinery in the nation. So I think it's time that the oil companies actually started doing, you know, something to address this issue, just like other industrial sectors.
Craig, do you see it that way with the transfer of actually thinking of it as a transfer of tax money?
I just wanted to point out that would be one way of formulating a carbon tax. There's still a lot of smart people out there who think that's what we should be doing instead of cap and trade. I brought a radio visual here, okay?
Make some noise, yeah.
Yeah, this is the stack of regulations, you know. Cap and trade is an extraordinary complex thing. It's very easy to get lost in the weeds, and some fear it will be easy to game as well.
All right. Yes, let's go back to the phones now. Van in San Jose, welcome.
Hi. My question is for alternate energy producers. Will they be awarded allowances that they can sell in the marketplace that would be equivalent to the energy that would be produced traditionally? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks. Severin?
No, and that would be double paying them. The whole idea is that we're going to raise the cost of the conventional energy. This isn't meant to be a subsidy program for alternative energy. This is actually putting a price on carbon. And the advantage is if you don't release carbon, you don't have to pay it. I do want to make a comment about the oil severance tax because people bring this up as some sort of alternative. It really has nothing to do with what California is doing. If we had an oil severance tax, which I do support, it would bring in revenues, but it would have absolutely no impact on the price of gasoline in California because oil is a worldwide market, and what California produces is a drop in that bucket.
Nor would it discourage pollution, probably.
Nor would it discourage pollution in any way.
Yeah.
It would bring in revenue. It would discourage a little bit of drilling, although I think that's generally overstated. It would have no impact on pollution or carbon emissions.
Here's an email from Emily and Shelley Sullivan. It's really, I guess, directed to you. The Andrew Chang report cited by Shelley Sullivan was paid for by the state's main manufacturing lobbying group, the California Manufacturers and Technology Association, and ignores the achievements of the policy while attempting to downplay the benefits of the law that protects human health and the environment. It's based on strategically placed data to generate a specific result and confusion over economics. Stating its conclusions as fact is incorrect. It's important to note that while AB 32 as a whole is going to have a slight economic impact on the state, it will also result in significant amounts of consumer savings at the gas pump and through avoided electricity purchases. Shelley Sullivan, you want to refute or comment on that?
Well, I would just like to state that Mr. Chang has been at different summits that I've attended, and he does acknowledge where the funding came for his study, yet he is an independent researcher, and that's what his research found, is that California will stand to lose $153 billion even under the optimistic conditions of AB 32. And I think that, you know, everyone, at least in this dialogue today, understands the fact that you can have one study from one area of the economy and another study from another area of the economy, and, you know, they're going to probably disagree. The state's
independent legislative analyst's office has confirmed that an auction is not necessary to reach our greenhouse gas emission goals, reduction goals. And, you know, that's really what AB 32 is all about. It's not ever meant to be a money generator for the state of California. It's meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
What about that point on the LAO, Severin Borenstein? What did you, are you familiar with that
study? Yeah. The LAO basically said if all you want to do is reduce greenhouse gases and you don't care how much it hurts consumers or other parts of the economy, you could give industry all of the permits and you would still have the incentives to reduce because it's a cap. You know, either way, you get to that cap output. But if we did that, it would have a much more negative impact on consumers and a much more positive impact on industry. So I don't think that would be very widely supported. I think that one sentence from that study has been taken, I would say, out of context to say that means we shouldn't have a auction, which is certainly not what LAO was proposing.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. In San Jose is our next stop. Timothy, welcome.
Hi, this question is for Dr. Borenstein. The European Union program that you spoke about, some results have recently come out that showed that it's been able to decouple the growth of emissions from the growth and recovery of the economy. And I wanted to see if you could comment on that and whether you thought that would happen in California.
I'm not familiar with that study. I actually think the EU ETS program is probably very difficult to sort out from all the other things that are going on in Europe, such as the German move away from nuclear power, the huge investment in solar and the huge subsidies for solar, the French growth of nuclear power. So there's a lot going on. I would be loath to attribute any particular change to the EU ETS. The prices in that market have been fairly low, and I think that it's probably had a fairly small impact on carbon emissions.
Okay. And what about, you know, the economy in Europe is doing horribly. Do you know, Severin, is there any, you know, pressure to ease the restrictions at all?
I don't think so, because actually the fact that the economy has been doing horribly means their emissions have been declining. And so the cap is less binding as a result.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, in California, the place that our market, our carbon market will become most binding is we're lucky enough to have a California economy that just takes off and is soaring, because then we will start producing more emissions.
All right, Tim, thanks for the call. That was actually not Tim in San Jose, but this is Timothy in San Jose. Welcome.
Yes, a question for particularly Jasmine and Severin. Has this whole program been vetted as to a constitutionality vis-a-vis the U.S. Constitution, in particular Section 10 of Article 1, where it the states are not permitted to do certain things without the consent of the United States Congress, including making money and emitting bills of credit and laying duties and imposts? It seems like this whole program is a creature that has been created that resembles a stock market in a bank. How can this be possible under the U.S. Constitution?
Craig Miller?
Well, I'm hardly a constitutional lawyer, but I know that one of the other keystone parts of the AB 32 plan, the low carbon fuel standard, actually has been taken to court on precisely that premise, that it would restrict interstate, you know, it would put a crimp in commerce outside of California. That's still pending in the courts. And there could be litigation against this before the auction.
Shelley Sullivan, is any of your coalition talking about that?
You know, our coalition doesn't talk about our strategy moving forward, but certainly I know many within the group and many other regulated stakeholders are thinking about what their options could be, and I know that some of those would be the legal option.
Severin Borenstein, has anything like that been, any lawsuits been filed in the Northeast where a similar market has been created?
I'm not sure of that. There definitely are concerns about that here. The Interstate Commerce Clause, which may be what the caller was referring to, I don't know the sections and articles, does create real problems in setting this up at a state level.
All right, Timothy, thanks for the call. Good question. Maybe we'll hear from a constitutional law professor before the hour is up. Let's go to Sunnyvale now, and Jack is on the line. Welcome.
Yes, my call. Excellent show, and I want to say I'm proud that my state is taking the lead in this area, and I'm really expecting it to be followed by others. And I'm wondering if the folks out there that are objecting to this program are taking into account that all the credible scientists in the world agree now that we're going to reach a point in climate change where the process is irreversible. And we don't know if we've already gone by that, because there's a momentum that will continue even if we stop putting additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere immediately. So it could be 5 years from now, 10 years, or we don't know. But you know, this is not a problem that is just a technological fix. And I'm wondering if you people are taking into account the fact that civilization could be brought to its knees. I mean, this is a very serious.
Yeah. Well, it's Shelley Sullivan, I guess I'll let you respond to that.
Sure. Well, as I stated at the beginning of the program, the business community has long supported a well-designed cap-and-trade program. So I'm not really here to defend whether someone believes in or does not believe in climate change. I mean, AB 32 is the law, and we need to live within the law. And our goal all along has been to design a program at minimal cost and that's well-designed, that doesn't extract billions of dollars from the state's economy when it's already so fragile, and it doesn't, you know, give the potential of leakage or additional job loss with the state.
Yeah. Severin Bornstein, though, it does point to the difficulty of the politics. I mean, no one wants to go first. You know, California now is going first, but, you know, really, this is you can't deal with this on a state-by-state basis. Congress did, the House, I think, did pass a cap-and-trade bill in 2009. It died in the Senate, but do you think, is there going to be any stomach in Washington, given the economy and other things, to deal with this?
I think that's very hard to forecast after the last election. I hope there will be. We really do need to get moving on this. Some of the skeptics or opponents say, look, the real problem is China. And that's true in a sense going forward. The developing world is emitting a lot more greenhouse gases. But the developed world is responsible for everything that's up there, almost everything that's already been put up there. And I think we do need to lead on it. California is not going to change that. What we might do is set an example that the rest of the state can pick up on, or the rest of the country can pick up on, and show that this can work smoothly and effectively.
All right. Well, we're going to have a chance to see that starting tomorrow. Severin Bornstein, a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, co-director of the Energy Institute there. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. Thanks also to Craig Miller, science editor at KQED. And by the way, you can read and hear more about all of this if you go to kqed.org/cap-and-trade. The folks there in the science unit have put together some nice visuals and explainers and so on. Thanks to you, Craig. Thanks also to Jasmine Ansar from the Union of Concerned Scientists and Shelley Sullivan as well from the AB 32 Implementation Group. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.